Hi, this is Randy Landry, and this is my podcast from Common Sense and Dash and DashAmerica.com. And I used to do them once a week, and I've kind of like gotten so busy now between my blog and trying to write my couple of books and home projects that I have not been able to do that consistently. So it's been a while since I've done my last podcast. And since I really hadn't planned anything out, I'm going to read one of my monthly imprimis article. This one is entitled, Are We Subjects or Citizens? Birthright, Citizenship, and the Constitution by Edward J. Erler. And so, I'm sure you've been here, unless you've been living under a rock or something like that, or in a cave, you've heard about the subject of birthright citizenship and that no other country has that. I mean, you go to visit or you're on a limited stay, maybe for work or whatever, and you have a baby and now baby's a citizen. You know, it's just kind of crazy. So without any further ado, let me go ahead and read this article. This summer, Americans will celebrate the semi-centennial of the Declaration of Independence, our nation's 250th birthday. Also this summer, the U.S. Supreme Court will render a decision in the case of Trump versus Barbara, a class action lawsuit challenging President Trump's executive order ending the practice of birthright citizenship. The two are connected because Trump versus Barbara involves fundamental issues fundamental to the meaning of the Declaration and future of the American experiment and Republican government. It is worth the time and effort of every citizen to understand its importance. Birthright citizenship, the policy whereby the children of illegal aliens born within the geographical limits of the United States are entitled to American citizenship, is a great magnet for illegal immigration. Many believe that this policy is an explicit command of the Constitution consistent with the British common law system. This is simply not true. The framers of the Constitution were, of course, well-versed in the British common law, having learned its essential principles from William Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England. As such, they knew that the very concept of citizenship was unknown in British common law. Blackstone speaks only of birthright subjectship or birthright allegiance, neither using the terms citizen or citizenship. The idea of birthright subjectship, as Blackstone readily admits, is derived from feudal law. It is the relation of master and servant. All who are born within the protection of the king owe perpetual allegiance as a debt of gratitude. According to Blackstone, this debt is intrinsic and cannot be forfeited, canceled, or altered. Birthright subjectship under the common law is thus the doctrine of perpetual allegiance. Americans' founders rejected this doctrine. The Declaration of Independence, after all, solemnly proclaims that the people, good people of these colonies, are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is, and ought to be, totally dissolved. According to Blackstone, the common law regards such an act as high treason. So the common law, the feudal doctrine of perpetual allegiance, could not possibly serve as a ground of American, i.e. Republican, citizenship. Indeed, the idea is too preposterous to entertain. James Wilson, a signer of the Declaration of Independence and a member of the Constitutional Convention, as well as a Supreme Court justice, captured the essence of the matter when he remarked, "Under the Constitution of the United States, there are citizens, but no subjects." The transformation of subjects into citizens was the work of the Declaration of the Constitution. Both are premised on the idea that citizenship is based on the consent of the governed, not the accident of birth. Who is a citizen? Citizenship, of course, does not exist by nature. It is created by law, and the identification of citizens has always been considered an essential aspect of sovereignty. After all, the founders of a new nation are not born citizens of the new nation they create. And indeed, this is true of all citizens of a new nation. They are not born into it, but rather become citizens by law. Although the Constitution of 1787 mentioned citizens, it did not define citizenship. It was not until 1868, with the ratification of the 14th Amendment that a definition of citizenship entered the Constitution. Here is the familiar language. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Thus, there are two components to American citizenship, birth or naturalization in the U.S. and being subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. We have somehow come today to believe that anyone born within the geographical limits of the U.S. is automatically subject to its jurisdiction, but this renders the jurisdiction clause utterly superfluous and without force. If this had been the intention of the framers of the 14th Amendment, it would simply have said that all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. are thereby citizens. Furthermore, the principal supporters of the 14th Amendment were explicit about the meaning of a subject to the jurisdiction. It meant owing exclusive allegiance to the U.S. and none to any other country. It is broadly agreed by constitutional scholars that the purpose of the 14th Amendment was to constitutionalize the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which was passed over the veto of the then President Andrew Johnson. A supermajority of both chambers of Congress approved the act, which established the citizenship of a newly freed slaves and the protection of their rights and liberties on the exact same basis as white citizens. Many in Congress initially argued that the passage of the 13th Amendment in 1865 granted citizenship and the rights and liberties attached to that status. Others argued that there should be explicit legislation, which resulted in the Civil Rights Act the following year. Still others thought the Civil Rights Act was insufficient because future majorities could repeal it. This concern became the impetus for the 14th Amendment, which constitutionalized the Civil Rights Act. The Citizenship Clause was a late addition to the 14th Amendment. The first draft merely stated that citizens were persons born in the U.S. or naturalized by the laws thereof. This language referred to the Joint Committee on Reconstruction, which reported back the language that became the Citizenship Clause. It is evident that the Joint Committee placed importance on the Jurisdiction Clause, which meant, at a minimum, that not all persons born in the U.S. were automatically citizens. Michigan Senator Jacob Howard, who was the manager of the 14th Amendment for the Reconstruction Committee, said that the addition of the Jurisdiction Clause was simply declaratory of what I regard as the law of the land already, referring to the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Illinois Senator Lyman Trumbull, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee and principal architect of the 13th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act of 1866, joined Howard in agreeing that the law of the land meant that the subject to the jurisdiction connoted complete jurisdiction, in other words, not owing allegiance to anyone else. Under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, Congress has the power to define by appropriate legislation who is just subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. Indeed, during debate over the amendment, Senator Howard, the author of the Citizenship Clause, attempted to assure skeptical colleagues that the new language was not intended to make citizens of the Indians, although the Indians were born within the nation's geographical limits. Howard steadfastly maintained they were not subject to the nation's jurisdiction because they owed allegiance to their tribes. Jurisdiction understood as allegiance, Howard pointed out, excluded not only Indians, but persons born in the United States who are foreigners, aliens, or who belong to the families of ambassadors or foreign ministers. Thus, subject to the jurisdiction does not simply mean, as is commonly thought today, subject to American laws or American courts. It means owing exclusive political allegiance to the U.S. Consider as well that in 1868, the year the 14th Amendment was ratified, Congress passed the Expatriation Act. This act permitted American citizens to renounce their allegiance and alienate or abandon their citizenship. Supported by Senator Howard and other leading architects of the 14th Amendment, the Expatriation Act characterized the right of expatriation as a natural inherent right of all people, indispensable to the enjoyment of the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Like the idea of citizenship, this right of expatriation is wholly incompatible with a British common law understanding of perpetual allegiance and subjectship. One member of the House of Representatives at the time expressed the general sense of the Congress when he proclaimed, "The old feudal doctrine stated by Blackstone and adopted as part of the common law of England is not only at war with the theory of our institutions, but is equally at war with every principle of justice and of sound public law. The common law established was characterized as an indefensible doctrine of indefeasible allegiance, a feudal doctrine wholly at odds with a republican government. In sum, what we today call birthright citizenship is a legacy of feudalism that was decisively rejected as the ground of American citizenship by the 14th Amendment and the Expatriation Act of 1868. It is absurd to believe that the 14th Amendment confers the boon of an American citizenship on the children of illegal aliens, nor does the denial of birthright citizenship visit the sins of the parents on the children, as is often claimed. Since the children of illegal aliens born in the U.S. are not being denied anything to which they have a right, a minor's allegiance should follow that of his or her parents. Furthermore, it is difficult to fathom how those who defy American law can derive benefits for their children by their own defiance, or that any sovereign nation would allow such a thing. Contrary to claims made by the defenders of birthright citizenship, there is no Supreme Court decision squarely holding that children of illegal aliens are automatically citizens of the U.S. In an 1898 decision, U.S. versus Wong, Tim Ark, the court did hold by a vote of 6-2 that a child of legal resident alien is entitled to birthright citizenship. Even then, the Wong Kim Ark decision was based on a mistaken premise that the 14th Amendment adopted the British common law system of birthright subjectship. The majority opinion did not explain how subjects were miraculously transformed into citizens within a supposedly adopted common law. Supreme Court Justice Horace Gray, writing the majority decision, merely stipulated that citizens and subjects were convertible terms, as if there were no difference between feudal monarchy and republicanism. Indeed, Chief Justice Melville Fuller wrote a powerful dissent arguing that the idea of birthright subjectship had been repealed by the American Revolution and the principles of the Declaration of Independence. The constitutional grounds for the majority opinion of Wong Kim Ark are tendentious, and that decisions could easily be overturned by our current Supreme Court this summer. This would, of course, require a proper understanding of the foundations of American citizenship and whether a majority of the members of our current court is capable of such is open to conjecture. But in any case, to say that children of illegal aliens are entitled to citizenship is one thing. After all, they are parents in the country with the permission of the U.S. It is entirely different with illegal aliens who are here without permission. Thus, repeal the current policy of birthright citizenship for the children of illegal aliens would not require a constitutional amendment. We have seen that the framers of the 14th Amendment agreed that Indians were not subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. beginning in 1870. However, Congress began to pass legislation offering citizenship to Indians on a tribe-by-tribe basis. Finally, in 1923, there was a universal offer to all tribes. Any Indian who consented could become an American citizen. This citizenship was based on reciprocal consent, an offer on the part of the U.S., and acceptance on the part of an individual. Thus, Congress used its legislative powers under the 14th Amendment to determine who was within the jurisdiction of the U.S. It could make a similar determination today, based on this legislative precedent, that children born in the U.S. to illegal aliens are not subject to American jurisdiction. A constitutional amendment is no more required now than it was in 1923. Decline of citizenship and of the nation-state. The same kind of confusion that has led us to accept birthright citizenship for the children of illegal aliens has led us to tolerate dual citizenship. We recall that the framers of the 14th Amendment specified that those who are naturalized must owe exclusive allegiance to the U.S. to be included within its jurisdiction, and the citizenship oath taken by new citizens today still requires a pledge of such allegiance. But in practice, dual citizenship and dual allegiance is allowed. This is a sign of the decline of American citizenship and of America as a nation state. Elite liberal opinion has for many years considered the sovereign nation or state as a historical anachronism in an increasingly globalized world. We are assured that human dignity adheres to the individual and does not require the mediation of the nation state. And this new universe of international norms demands on the part of this nation-state to exclusive allegiance or for assimilation violate universal personhood. In such a universe, citizenship will become superfluous or superfluous or even dangerous. Those who advocate open borders tend to share this cosmopolitan view of transnational citizenship. Illegal immigrants, they say, are merely seeking to support their families and improve their lives. Borders, according to them, should not stand in the way of family values, those universal values that refuse to recognize the importance or relevance of mere political boundaries. Somehow, for those who hold these views, political exclusivity and the requirement of exclusive allegiance are opposed to these universal values, if not to human decency itself. We must constantly remind ourselves, however, of the historical fact that the constitutional democracy has existed only in the nation-state, and that the demise of the nation-state will almost certainly mean the demise of constitutional democracy. No one believes that the European Union or similar organizations will ever produce constitutional government. Indeed, the EU is well on its way to becoming an administrative tyranny, nor would the homogeneous world state, the EU, on a global scale, be a constitutional democracy. It would be the administration of universal personhood without the inconvenience of having to rely on the consent of the governed. The doctrine of birthright citizenship and acceptance of dual citizenship are signs that we in the U.S. are on the verge of reinstituting feudalism and replacing citizenship with a master-servant relationship. The continued vitality of the nation-state and of constitutional government depends on a continued vitality of citizenship, which carries with it exclusive allegiance to what the Declaration of Independence calls a separate and equal nation. Unless we recover an understanding of the foundations of citizenship, we will find ourselves in a world where there are subjects but no citizens. Pretty interesting article. Hope you found that illuminating. I concur with it, and I do not believe that people are automatically granted citizenship if they're born in the United States. They have to be part of the country, just like their parents have to be also, if not citizen naturalized or what have you, or under our aegis. And illegal aliens are obviously not really. They have not signed over any kind of allegiance to this country. So why should their children automatically be granted that status? Just like the Indians. The Indians were obviously born here, but if they had a different allegiance, then they didn't really want to be part of this country, so they were not considered citizens. Well, let's see. Also, I'm sure I'm going to do a little side note here to fill up a little time. I'm sure you're probably aware, again, you'd have to be living under a rock not to know about the and military engagement with Israel and the United States and Iran. And also, the fact is that the rest of our countries and NATO are either not helping at all or are basically standing in our way of us completing this mission or assignment or whatever you want to call it. It's not really a war, because only technically Congress can declare war, and Congress has not done so. It's part of a threat, a military threat against the United States and a threat against our allies, because if left on their own wherewithal, whatever, they would have had nuclear weapons. But the fact remains is that Iran is allied with Russia, North Korea, also China, among other countries, all of which have the nuclear weapons. So it seems to me, if they really, 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 really wanted a nuclear bomb or nuclear missile or what have you, all they'd have to do is like say, okay, we'll give you a year's free supply of oil for those weapons, and they would have it. I mean, it's just common damn sense. Nobody talks about the fact that they are friendly with nuclear powers. And Russia has plenty of extra weapons, bombs and missiles that they can spare. They've got enough to destroy the United States and our allies without even thinking about it. So what would be 4 or 5 missiles or bombs here or there? Would mean nothing. So I mean, okay, so we bomb them into oblivion, yet they still have oil, and they still have a way of purchasing military weapons. And how did we prove it? Okay, after the fact, after the bomb blew up, we could, oh, we could check the radiation, say, oh, it came from Russia. Right, okay, who gives a shit? The country is destroyed, or a major city is destroyed, or millions of people are dead. And the suitcase, they could buy a suitcase bomb, as they call them, okay, that have, you know, 10 to 15 kilotons of power enough to wipe out a city or a part of a city. So, yeah, you know, Iran's been a threat to this country, and they've been rattling the chains and cages and all this kind of shit for 47 plus years, ever since the Shah of Iran was usurped. And then the hostage crisis and all that, and the bombing of the coal and our military bases and all this kind of barracks. And so literally hundreds of people have been killed by Iran. Probably more than that, because they've been funding terrorism for decades. And if you want to go along with that line of thought, they're directly responsible for 9/11. So I think they need their asses kicked. And they're also, they're just totally batshit crazy. I mean, they're bombing all these neutral countries just because it's like a, you ever seen a spoiled child not get his way? He just throws a temper tantrum and he don't give a shit who hears him screaming and hollering and carrying on, or what those people think about him. That's kind of like how Iran has been acting. And in some cases, it's a little bit how our Israel has been acting a little bit too. They're a little petulant on the side. But, and I could throw in Ukraine as well, and even Russia. I think you ought to be satisfied, not so much satisfied with what you have, but work within your, within your limitations. And just because you believe a certain way doesn't mean that way is the only way or the right way, okay? That's really, and that's also another thing, you know, I talk about religion. I don't like to talk about religion too much, but that's the fact is that nobody living, that we know of anyway, has directly spoken to God, all right? Directly, I mean, actually face-to-face, okay? And even in history, did Jesus actually see God, okay, face-to-face? Or did he just hear the word? So all the, our biblical, our books and all this kind of stuff, and the Quran, all this kind of stuff, are basically interpretations made by dead people, okay? Not direct, not person, God to person order, stuff like that. So if they've done these experiments over the years, and if I could get a room with like 20, 30 people, and the first person is told a story, and then by the time it gets to the last person, that story or that information is totally unrecognizable, okay? And that's in one room in a matter of like a half an hour. We're expected to believe that this information that's been passed on for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years, well, in some cases it was hundreds of years before it was actually even written down. It was just word of mouth. Now, Islam, it's a little bit more, they kind of like understood that that could happen. And so they were a little bit more conscientious of making sure the word was followed through. But there still wasn't room for interpretation. And the human memory, except for the rare case of certain people, is imperfect at best, okay? I mean, you can remember a lot of stuff, but you're going to forget, you know, a couple, you know, if you memorize a page of information, unless you've got a didactic or perfect photographic memory, you're going to forget words. And if you have a paragraph with missing words, that paragraph's meaning may be totally changed. Just by a couple of words, an and or a the or that. I mean, just look at documents that are for legal documents. One or two words can totally throw up, i.e. the birthright citizenship, 14th Amendment. Those three or four words, subject to, have been like a point of contention for over 100 years. So say you want to get in a war, you want to fight people, all this kind of stuff. It's insane. And now I'm reading. I'm a very curious person. You probably all know that. I mean, I've written dozens of books and I've studied and I've written hundreds and hundreds of podcasts. I'm a blog articles and podcasts on a lot of different subjects. And I'm like a big sponge, 63-year-old sponge almost, but yeah, still a big sponge. I'm bigger than I want to be. But the point is that I like information. So I'm reading two books on Sharia law, so I can understand. So I hate to not know the information when I talk, speak about a subject. I want to know as much as I can. Saying about Antifa, I had never heard of Antifa, so I had bought a couple books on Antifa, and I read about the subject and all that kind of shit. So I know pretty well, a good amount of information about Antifa. The same now as what I'm learning about Sharia law. And it's just like, half the population of the world basically has no rights according to Sharia law. Absolutely freaking no rights. They can't even go outdoors without having a male counterpart be with them, okay? Maybe they could go out in their backyard and hang some clothes, you know, to dry or whatever, you know, on a line. That would be about it, the extent of it. But they just wanted to go outdoors for a walk around the neighborhood. They'd have to have a chaperone, a male chaperone. And the effrontery of it is it could even be one of their children. Male children, of course. If the fact remains is that she is a widow or divorcee. And obviously she's not going to have custody of her children because the husband, the spouse, the male spouse would have that custody right without even thinking about it. So they're basically prisoners in their home, prisoners in their country, the whole bit. And what religion that's supposed to be humane and all this kind of stuff and just come up with one of its clauses in there that women have absolutely no right whatsoever, and even in current days. So we're back to like feudal society kind of thoughts there. Back in the day when women were not allowed, they didn't want women to be able to read. They didn't want women, they could not own property or inherit property. About the only woman that could would be the queen if she was like the only. And even then, it was contentious what, you know, which power she would have. I mean, eventually, we did have some queens in England that did become powerful and all that. But I don't think initially that was the case. So, and again, I don't want to go too far on this because I am not exactly a student of English history. I just get so bogged down with all their kings and queens that it's just like, oh my God. And all their way of thinking. And eventually I will put myself to that after I finish up these next two books. I am going to take care of that, address that weakness in my education and my knowledge base. Because I don't like to have any weaknesses at all that are evident. Especially something that's, you know, it's kind of important to American history as well. I mean, we did take some stuff from England. And it affected us and how our country has progressed throughout the millennia. So, I think I rambled enough, but you get to kind of get the point, I think, that is that words mean a lot. The exact context of the words and how they're put, you know, set up. So, and it's so easily to forget what was said. I mean, now, right now, I've been speaking for over 28 minutes. And do you think I remember every damn word I said? Probably not, and I don't, okay? I could not repeat word for word what I said. Now, I know the gist of it, the context of it. I'd probably be pretty good. I could discuss it again. But I don't remember exactly every word I said. So, how could I, if I were able to live 100 years or 200 years, how could I remember that, everything I've said on this particular, you know, thing? Even if it was something very important, which it is. The subject is important. So, my point is, why get your up in a dander here about religion when we don't even know if what's in the Bible is actually accurate? Okay? We really don't. And we know the Bible is not accurate because they've had so many commissions and all that over the years and how before the Bible was actually set up between Old and New Testament. Parts of all these stories, information, whatever that was by these different individuals was kept out to keep the Bible a fairly succinct size or length or whatever. So, I mean, who decided what should be included in the Bible? These Gospels were not included. I mean, more were not included than were included, basically. So, I mean, weren't they important to be? Shouldn't they have been included? Shouldn't the Bible have been maybe 2 volumes or 3 volumes? Maybe. Could have been. So, all right, I guess I'll stop there. So, hope you found this interesting and illuminating. You have a great day and take care.